A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You know, I've been talking about earned media value for quite some time on this podcast. My friends at Eisenberg have just raised the bar on earned media benchmarks with their Social Index. Social Index now gives you globally earned media values across a growing list of 6 geographies for all your KPIs across the top 7 social platforms: Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Snapchat, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube. You can now visualize these values for deeper analysis, and they have a look back window over 2 years of historical comparisons. Social Index is updated daily. Don't get stuck with old data. Over 1,000 companies have used the Social Index to understand the ROI of their social campaigns. And if you work with a social agency, you should demand they incorporate earned media values into your reports. Get your earned media value for social content. Visit earnedmediavalues.com/Allen. Again, that's earnedmediavalues.com/ALAN.
For all of us, it's about predicting where the consumer is going and getting half of it right.
One of the things we want to do is create ads that don't suck.
Embracing change creates great possibility.
I'm Alan Hart, and this is Marketing Today.
Today on the show, I've got Jeremy King. He's the founder and CEO of Attest, a consumer research SaaS company. Jeremy's been on the program before on episode 298. I encourage you strongly to go back and check out that episode as well. It's always action-packed and factual in our conversation. Jeremy started his career as a scientist focusing on genetics, ecology, and animal behavior. He worked for McKinsey & Company for 9 years and got his MBA at Harvard Business School. Attest is headquartered in both New York and London, has customers that include big behemoths like Unilever, Santander, Walgreens Boots, Bloomberg, and Trustpilot. And he's raised close to $75 million in funding with backing from global venture capital firms like NEA and Schroders. On the show today, he does not disappoint. We start off talking about another ocean creature, and you'll hear more about that. Talk about how Attest is doing. And then we spend a considerable amount of time talking about zero-party data, how that's playing out in terms of consumers' expectations with how their data would be treated, their blocking behavior around privacy, and what marketers should be thinking about, and potentially who's going to win, who's going to lose, and much, much more. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Jeremy King. Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Delighted to be back.
For those that are listening, Jeremy was on episode 298, so a couple years ago, I believe at this point. But last time we talked, we started talking about the peacock mantis shrimp. And I have to ask, because it was a fascinating conversation, do you have any other favorite ocean creatures?
I have many. I collect ocean creatures in my mind and in my knowledge. But I think another one that I really like often pretends to be a peacock mantis shrimp. As we talked about last time, peacock mantis shrimp are really cool, in a way dangerous, in a way colorful, in a way visionaries, and have amazing biology, engineering, and technology at their disposal. But my other favorite is called the mimic octopus, now Moctopus mimicus in Latin. And it can pretend to be a whole bunch of other sea creatures. So this is an octopus that's quite small. It's about the size of maybe a volleyball when you stack it all together. but it can pretend to look like a mantis shrimp, where it pokes its eyes out of a hole, it puts its body in the ground, and it can put out little arms, so it looks like a mantis shrimp, and everything on the reef thinks, this is a mantis shrimp, I shouldn't go anywhere near it. It can also, as it moves from place to place, make its body round and long and look like a poisonous flatfish. It can also move through the water, particularly when it's threatened, and spread out its arms and wave those arms in a way that really mimics the behavior and the locomotion of a lionfish, which is a red and white fish that has very poisonous long spines, and all the other sea creatures know to go nowhere near it, and it moves in a certain way. A mimic octopus can not only mimic what it looks like, but also how it moves through the water. And then last one, it can also pretend to be a very poisonous sea snake. It sits in a hole in the reef or in the sand, puts out two arms, makes itself black and white stripy, and it can wave those arms around, and it looks like a long and exciting but very poisonous sea snake. So this octopus has learned to mimic all these different animals, their behavior, their locomotion, exactly what they look like, and it can deploy these mimic behaviors at different times. And I think it's a really cool part of biology, because this is a tiny creature that has three hearts and distributed brains. And it's just a really cool animal that, to me, is emblematic of why underwater worlds are so cool.
I love all of these examples. You never disappoint. Like, you never disappoint with fascinating things that I've never learned about myself. And I think the last time we talked, but I think it's even true with the mimic octopus, is these things could be easily written into like superhero novels or movies. I could totally see the peacock mantis shrimp and the mimic octopus teaming up, and the comedy between the mimic octopus trying to mimic the peacock mantis shrimp, and the banter between the two of them.
That would be fun. Fundamentally, these things exist. They have real superpowers, like Marvel characters and DC superheroes. But they exist in the real world. If you saw a mimic octopus, you'd think it was quite boring and lame and unextraordinary, but it can do these amazing things.
I love it. Maybe one day we'll put together a movie script.
That would be fun. That would be fun. In the meantime, for anyone under the age of six, there's Octonauts. Highly recommended.
Nice. Last time we talked about your company and founding Attest. Tell us a little bit about like how the company's doing. What types of customers are you serving today? Give us a little update on the company itself.
Yeah, we've grown a lot. We now have customers in lots of different countries. We work with a huge number of B2C businesses mainly, also agencies and investors that are interested in B2C interests and spaces. So we've got customers as big as British Gas and Unilever and Walgreens Boots, and as small as very exciting peanut butter and beer attacker brands, fintech companies like Wise, formerly TransferWise, big agencies like JCDecaux, and they use our product to understand the customers that they don't have yet, the ones they want to know about, the ones that decide whether you win or lose. And we're now doing that in many more places, many more organizations. And what we're trying to do behind the scenes is constantly make our product better, so that doing this very useful and borderline impossible thing can be really easy and accessible for anyone to use all the time. And that's why we talk about inform every intuition, dissolve any doubt. We want Attest to inform you and give you new inputs. Whenever you have intuitions or ideas, you can add data, and we try to make that easy. Dissolve any doubt. When you're choosing between difficult things, you can delete the doubt and move with confidence because you went and discovered something new or you tested. So all we're trying to do is make that easy. And since we last spoke, I hope we've done some things to make that easier, more powerful, but also in more places for more things. In particular, we now can run research in 59 countries. We just added Uruguay and many languages. And running research in lots of countries and lots of languages in parallel that you write once, but can run 50, 55, 59 times, that's something we've just made really easy. Yeah, it's been a fun time.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And I know I think back when we did the last episode, we did a small survey together, and I still reference that survey to this day. We were looking at the one question in particular I still reference a lot, is like, where does purpose fall in people's buying behavior? And kind of asking it the right way lends you to understand that, yeah, it's there, but it's after price, quality, all these other components of a product and a reason why you would purchase. And so I think it just pinpoints for me, like putting your question in context and then making sure you have the data to make the appropriate decisions, right? Like, you guys are at the helm of enabling many companies to do that, which is great.
Thank you. Couldn't say it better myself, but appreciate that. And it's always nice to hear when people run real research and find it useful and remember it.
Oh, of course. I know you recently, you guys have published a report, and we'll spend a little bit of time talking about zero party data, but the report's Zero Party Data Revolution, How to Grow Marketing Effectiveness. Tell me a little bit about, like, why this report, why now is a good time to publish something like this?
We're often using our own product to run research, mainly because we're interested in what's going on. And sometimes we publish it externally when we find that there's something cool, interesting to talk about. The specific situation here is that third-party cookies are dying. In the EU, GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, has been in place since 2018, and gradually companies have had to gain permission to use cookies in tracking people around the internet and on websites, and that's happening in the US now too. And gradually all companies and all digital advertising companies, finally Google, I think, is the last mover, are converging to the point where they aren't and cannot use third-party cookies. So this thing, third-party cookies, that used to make it really easy for digital advertising to target consumers, track you around the internet, make sure that advertisers can show ads to you at the right time that are highly personalized at the exact moments because they know a lot about you and your behavior and where you are, that power has been completely removed now. And something else has to replace it. Advertisers need to spread advertising wider, use new methods, rely on more old school marketing methods, the type that doesn't rely on tracking or targeting users in very fine detail based on installing third-party cookies and following you around the internet. There's two interesting things happening right now that make this complicated. One, advertisers are having to change their behavior. And it's a bit like, to use a cooking analogy, restaurants sometimes buy in sauces, gravies, pre-prepared dishes, and then they heat them in the microwave and serve them. That was easy, but expensive and a bit lazy. And that's how I feel about third-party cookies. It makes advertising very easy. What marketers and advertisers need to do now is go back to actually doing the real cooking. It's often far better, much cheaper. The raw materials are cheaper. You don't have to pay third parties to buy in sources and products and finished dishes. You have to cook them and heat them from raw ingredients. It's just a bit less lazy. But the way that you have to do marketing advertising is fundamentally changing, because this power that has existed over the last 5, 10, 15 years has now been effectively deleted. The second thing that's really observable is that consumers are far more aware of their own data, privacy rights, the value of their own data. Since 2018 in the EU, GDPR has required you to ask for consent for cookies. So now all consumers, whenever you log into any website, one of the first things is, do you consent to cookies? If you don't, you can reject them. So consumers are far more aware that this is happening, and that's happening in the US and many other markets now too. So consumers are aware not only that they used to be tracked around the internet by third-party cookies, but now they have some controls and that there might be a different deal or a different relationship with advertisers or websites. And many consumers in many different ways have an opinion on this and have changed their behavior accordingly. But the awareness in consumers that cookies existed and that there is now a deal to be done for my data in exchange for something, that's far more ubiquitous now. Not universal, but far more ubiquitous. Put those two things together, it's a huge change in how we advertise, market, and work with consumers in many countries and regions.
It's a fascinating shift in the landscape of advertising and consumers. I know in your report, you guys ask about privacy concerns and to consumers. And I think there's this, I don't know if it's a myth, but there's maybe it's the US, I'm not sure, but there seems to be in the ethos this notion that consumers, they really don't care. Like, they like free things and they'll just continue to do things that are allow them to not pay. But I'm curious what you guys learned, like how concerned are people about their privacy, and does it vary by age or anything like that?
Yeah, this is what's changed. A few years ago, Americans would gladly give up their data to see how they look with a different hairstyle, find out which movie star they most resemble. Let's not name the website, but
right,
you know
right,
what I'm talking
right.
about. yes. And what you were doing was supplying your background demographic and data and fingerprinting, adding some more data on top of that, a few clicks and of your behavior can give advertisers a huge amount of data about what you care about. And fundamentally, you're giving away data and getting back something which isn't particularly valuable. Fast forward to today, our research, 84.1% of people in the US are concerned about data privacy when interacting with brands online. And that's across all age groups, even Gen Z digital natives, 18 to 25. You might think that they have a different deal, a new deal, a different basis for making a decision, but 82.7% of them are concerned about privacy when interacting with brands online. And going deeper, these consumers are presented with choices, and we found that 36.6% of web users decline to share their data specifically because they don't want to be targeted with advertising. So consumers, not all consumers, but about a third, specifically don't want to be targeted with advertising and withhold their data in order that advertisers don't get it. So above 80% have a concern, above a third are doing something very deliberate about it, and the people that are losing are the advertisers.
Yeah, it's pretty a big shift. I think a big shift and something maybe we're not paying close enough attention to. I was also surprised by the thing you highlight around people's blocking of tracking and cookies. And you hinted at it there with the last stat. But can you tell me what you found and what it almost felt like to me as I was reading it, that some of the requirements now, the pop-ups to say accept or decline cookies or tracking, actually fueling the behavior more. So I would love to hear you talk about it a little bit.
Totally. So consumers, it's easy to say consumers when they're presented with a choice are making a different choice now. It's easy to say customers and consumers are more aware of this choice, but we tried to put some numbers behind it. Let's look at two things specifically and try and compare it to the past. Thing one, likelihood to habitually opt out of first-party cookies by age group. Younger people, 18 to 24, this is in the US, 26.7% of people habitually opt out of first-party cookies. So when you visit the website, you click, no, you can't track my cookies. That rises to 34.7% for people over 45 to 54. And for the older group, 55 to 56 to 64-year-olds, 41.3% of them habitually opt out. So we're getting close to half of people just habitually hitting, no, you can't track me every website forever. And it takes a few extra clicks, but people are doing it. The second thing is habitually opting out of mailing lists by age group. So here we have quite a wide range. I'll use the same age groups again. For the younger group, 18 to 24-year-olds, 53.3% of people habitually opt out of mailing lists, and that rises to 64.3% for 55 to 64-year-olds. So people, when they're presented with these choices, do you accept cookies? Starting to say no. Older people say no far more often. Younger people often happy just to get on with it and say yes. And I'll come back to why in a second. Mailing lists, it used to be consumers just say, yeah, I'll add me to the mailing list, I'll delete it later, move you to spam. Now they're actively opting out and declining, unticking the box, not consenting to marketing. And across all age groups, more than half of people do that habitually. We also ran some interesting follow-up research at a qualitative level to figure out what is the behavior behind this. And particularly the younger people, they do habitually accept cookies. But what they're doing instead is they habitually, every day, clear their cookies. They're like, yeah, I'll make it easy. One day of browsing, I'll run through the internet. You can track me for a day. But every day I will clear my cookies. And therefore, I could worry-free browse through a few sites and click accept and just get on with what I'm trying to do. But track me for more than one day, I've made it impossible. Sorry, not sorry. So it's just interesting to see this huge paradigm shift in what used to be quite a lazy, de facto passive opt-in to all these things. Now it's an active choice and people are acting upon it very differently, but they are all aware of this choice and many are making this choice.
Fascinating. Just the shifts and the dynamics and it's pretty universal for the most part, it seems, at least across age groups. They're fairly similar in some respect.
Yeah, what's interesting is when we run a cut by what type of website you're looking at. The ones that relatively win are retail websites. So across all age groups, likelihood to habitually opt out of first-party cookie data by website type is just under 39% for retail websites. For social media, that rises to 47%. So consumers perceive these different websites to have different levels of trust and express it with their ability to opt in or not opt in to first-party cookies. Third-party cookies are legal. First-party cookies now becoming an active choice, and consumers make different choices across different venues. Social media, the worst. Retail, the best.
Love it. And the report goes even further to say, if we can't collect data on users or they're opting out at high rates, how does this impact where I can place advertising? And It seems like your report also highlights the interest level is growing around paying for ad-free versions of various platforms, and which now takes us as an advertiser or marketer takes entire inventory out of play. So what are you seeing in the data from that respect?
Yeah, so this phenomenon of ad-free versions is a complete disaster for advertisers. So it's not only that the venue for that advertising is being switched off and the spend is no longer coming your way. The venue, the website, is taking it instead of you. We ran some research about the interest levels in this, specifically on Meta by age. So 55 to 64-year-olds, older people, only 5.4% are interested or likely to purchase the ad-free version of Meta. And this is combining interested or likely. That number, so it's 5.4% for people over 55. That number for people who are 18 to 24 is 40.6%. Completely different view on exactly the same issue. And wow. I think maybe these 18 to 24-year-olds are aware of the value. They want a better experience and they are interested in making this trade. Older people are not interested in making this trade, maybe because they're not interested in Meta at all. But that stark difference, 8 higher in 18 to 24 versus 55 to 64, super interesting. And when you play this all out, it's almost what biologists call an extinction event, like when a meteor hits the world and all the dinosaurs go extinct. These consumers want to know explicitly what they're sharing, why they're sharing data, and what they might get in return. To your point, some are even willing to pay. But rather than having their movements on the website, on a website tracked across the internet and behind the scenes, there's a different trade that consumers are now increasingly aware of and making in different ways. And paying for ad-free versions is just one form that is starting to take.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you if people send you the same generic conversation starters they message everyone else? Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
As you think about marketers and business people, like, what do you think we can do about it? What are your hypotheses on what we can do?
I should disclose a bias here because obviously I'm going to say what we do is the answer. But let me talk at a more general level. So as the music stops on third party, the party's over. It's time and pretty much now the only choice to get on the zero party data dance floor. So instead of getting data from someone else from third parties through third party cookies, you have to instead generate the data a different way. You can offer deals in exchange for data. Club cards and loyalty programs are a good way to do that. If you give a grocery store access to your list of purchases to match it to your ID, you get back special offers. That's a deal that's been around for a long time. But we see those deals becoming more and more overt, saying you're giving us data and in exchange, we're going to give you something back. Could be points, could be access, could be game rewards, could be a better internet experience, could be upgrades. The other way to think about it is collecting this data more actively, explaining why we are collecting data from you, showing you that the data collection is safe and how your data will be stored. Maybe even in the wake of recent scandals, showing that your personal information will not be collected, but your opinion and views will, and that information will be segregated. So collecting this data much more actively and overtly, saying we do want to collect your data and here is the reason why, and/or offering you something in return, better deals, a better discount, rewards, loyalty benefits, better experiences. That's now the deal that zero-party data and the demise of third-party cookies has created. And again, this is a huge paradigm shift for marketers, advertisers, and brands. It used to be that you could do this passively. Now you have to offer this very different deal. You want the data, you have to give something back. The form that takes is very different. How you get data from affluent older people is very different from how you get data from people who are more economically challenged and younger. And the nature of this deal is what will cause brands and marketers to get more or less data. And that data, I think we believe, is what will cause them to succeed or fail. So this is really important. And how you can act about it and act upon this opportunity is to find more ways to get zero-party data in. And there's a bunch of ways to do that.
I would love to, let's talk a little bit about what consumers want and this value exchange that you're highlighting and making sure that there's an active value exchange for the data, and that in some cases being overt makes sense. In some cases, giving you a deal or value of some form or another. But I also think there's a level of engagement that like a platform like yours in terms of surveying or polling or engaging with your audience and your consumer makes sense too. But like, how do you think about what consumers want?
So we obviously ran a bunch of research on this as well. So what we found is that this is across the US and cut by different regions and age bands. Americans are much happier to share their data actively than through passive data collection methods. When presented with that choice, Americans want to do this actively rather than be passively monitored. Almost 48% of Americans would prefer a brand to capture their data via a survey rather than cookies, which is just under 19%, or social media monitoring, which is 18%. So almost three times as many people want this to be an active thing rather than a passive thing. And we also ran through when websites or brands display how data capture methods are being put to work, using transparent data capture methods to collect data, it gives brands a bit of a halo effect. 57.8% of consumers feel more at ease when using a brand's website when it's transparent exactly what is going on, where the data is being collected, that you opt in, and knowing how that data is used. So as a brand, as a marketer, if you can present this choice and do it transparently, you can really help consumers make the right choice. And many consumers are looking for you to help them make this choice. And it seems, based on that information, that consumers will reward you if you are more transparent and more purposeful and more overt in how you do this. And in the modern world, brands benefit from gathering data actively, not passively, because the increased trust has a knock-on effect. Nearly 50% of consumers are likely to take actions that help marketers, opting into a mailing list as an example. So not only are the consumers happier to share the data that helps brand target them with marketing, they also become more receptive to marketing and brand love in the process of doing so. So there's a win here. It's what the consumers want, what gives brands better data. And a bit like my cooking analogy, the raw materials and how you do this is actually much cheaper. The food is much healthier. It has better margins, a better process. It's just a bit less lazy. And it's not what brands have been doing for the last 10 to 15 years. So right. It's a huge change, an easy change to make. And the deal just needs to be transparent and consumers will reward you.
I love the analogy of it just needs to be less lazy. And it is, to your point, like I'm thinking about it, I'm like, this is not hard. It takes time. It takes thought. But yeah, it's just not clicking the easy button.
Yeah. Have you ever seen, I might be going on a tangent here. Have you ever seen Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares, where he goes to the restaurant
and
fixes it? So there's this show where Gordon Ramsay goes to a restaurant that's struggling, has no customers. It's usually in a strip mall on the side of a highway. And he goes in there and generally does two things. One is people don't know the restaurant is there or what it does because it's very confusing. He makes it less confusing. And the fact that Gordon Ramsay visited is usually quite a good marketing ploy in the first place. So they do a big reopening. They change the signage. The other thing they do is he walks through the kitchen and the walk-in refrigerator and into the pantry, and finds that they have these big vats of pre-made sauces, and that they cook 50 chicken fillets and then they keep them for 3 days. And no wonder people don't like this, because they're all the food and ingredients are bought in and it doesn't taste fresh and it's not made on site and it was cooked 3 days ago. So no wonder customers hate it. And he shows them, hey, I got a cabbage, some beef mince and some interesting sauces that you already had in your pantry, and I made these 10 amazing dishes. This is what you can do. And you guys are trained chefs and amazing restaurateurs. You can do this. You know how to do this. And deep down, what you've been doing all along is wrong. And he shows them that it's actually way cheaper to do it this way. You're giving less money away to third parties, digital advertisers in this case. You can make these things yourself. You just need to bother to try, and consumers will reward you. The food is fresher. It's more customized. It tastes better. They recognize it. They can taste it, feel it, and sense that you care about them. It's exactly what's happening in digital advertising. You don't need to buy it in from third parties. Also, particularly in the EU, you can't. It's been illegal for some time. And consumers recognize that it's fresher. They can taste the love in the process, and they reward you with their feedback and their dollars.
I love it. That's a great analogy, and not a tangent either. It works. If we play all of this out, I'm going to have you get your crystal ball out, and that's always dangerous, I know. Who do you think wins? Who wins? Who loses? What are the hypotheses around that?
So the big losers are the advertisers and companies that have relied on third-party cookies for so long. So if all of your marketing eggs have been in the basket of tracking people around the internet and hitting them with digital display ads at moments that suit you, with ever increasing levels of weaponization, that choice for you no longer exists. So if that was 100% of your marketing campaign and go-to-market motion, that has just been deleted. So the losers are the people who were all in on that and failed to see this regulatory and consumer expectation change coming. And now overnight, those organizations have to find a different way. And that's a very difficult change to make. The winners, I think, are the brands that have seen this change coming at a regulatory and consumer expectations level, and are those that can experiment with different rewards and different trades with different consumers and different demographics. As I mentioned, and as we saw in the data, different types of consumers want to do this trade in different ways. Younger people have different expectations than older people, more or less affluent people, different geographic regions of the US and of the world. The different trades are different for different consumers. But at the heart of it is, if you want consumers to give you data, you have to give them back something. And that might be a reason, as simple as the reason why you're collecting it. It might be some sort of reward. It might be some sort of evidence that their data is going to be kept safely. But what you get back is they will proceed with their shopping, their transaction, their interest, their discovery of whatever you're selling or advertising to them. And they will recognize you as a brand that actually cares about their digital interests. So you get back two benefits. And so the winners are the brands that have moved away from doing the easy things and jamming out loads of highly customized, weaponized digital marketing, to those instead who have been experimenting with different methods that can hit and unlock consumers that you care about, but in ways that those consumers recognize as being fair, safe, and that they also care about themselves and reward. And the root cause of this, it's the regulatory change, but the most important thing is the consumer's awareness that this trade is happening and that they have the choice available, which is just supported by regulation. So it's easy to say this is a regulatory-driven thing, but it's far more important to think about what the consumers want and to hit them with a trade and the basis of value that they recognize and reward. And those are the winners.
Love it. Great advice. Great advice. I'll encourage people to check out the full report. It'll be linked, of course, in the show notes of the show. And it's always fascinating to have you on. And the number of stats that you can regurgitate is unbelievable. As well. We'll probably have to slow this episode down so we can capture all these stats, which are great.
I'm sorry. But I just love all these things a bit too much sometimes.
No, it's awesome. It's full packed of facts, which I love. I love, I love. Switching gears, we usually always like to go behind the scenes and behind the microphone and get to know you a little bit better. We've already asked you my favorite question on episode 298, which is, what experience of your past defines or makes up who you are today? And we talked about this film, Short Circuit, which I loved as well when I was younger, and the character Johnny Five in there and soaking up inputs. And we talked about your experiences at McKinsey as well, the hard choices of doing the right things in critical moments and learning to trust your instincts. So I'll shift the question today and just curious to know, what impact has entrepreneurship had on you?
On me personally?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think two things. So A, entrepreneurship throws at you a series of tests and challenges at a rate and diversity, which is much harder than working at McKinsey or any other situation I've come across. So it is extremely normal that every day you have these sort of huge moral, ethical, emotional trade-offs that you have to make just at a constant pace. One particular one that always comes to mind is there was a time where it was when we were a much smaller company. We had cash flow and funding for the months of February, March, and April 2018, I think it was. But the time was November 2017, and I couldn't say for sure that we had full cash flow to cover December payroll. So we definitely had the cash. We definitely had the funding. We were good in the long term, but we had a bit of a liquidity crunch, particularly in the holidays or Christmas period. And I was like, this is really bad. How did this happen? And you're faced with, do I hide this or do I tell people about it? Do I bury it and hope it goes away? 10, 20% chance and rising slightly? Or do you just pretend it never happened and hope that goes away forever? And entrepreneurship throws these things at you every day. And at that time, I chose the light route and told the company, hey, you should know about this. If I was in your shoes, I'd want to know. I told every single person altogether, you should know about this, working on it, going to get this down to zero as soon as possible. But right now, hand on heart, 20% chance you miss December payroll. Making this number one priority, thought you should know. And they're like, thanks. And they reward you that with trust. Also told our investors. And then within a few days, one had written back and written us a zero interest, 6-month expiry convertible loan note for £100,000, saying, here it is. We know it's a liquidity thing, not a structural thing. Here's this thing. If you need it, sign it. Wire the money in a couple of days. Problem solved. Get on with building the business. So I was like, wow, the light route was the right way to go here. But I think entrepreneurship throws these lessons and tests at you constantly. And that's had a big impact on me, because you discover very quickly where your moral compass leads you, what really matters to you at these moments of trade-off. They're often head and heart and ethics and moral decisions, as well as business and shareholder value decisions. And entrepreneurship has taught me a lot more about where my morals, ethics, fundamental beliefs lie, because they are referenced and tested so often. The other thing I think I've learned is for me personally, there were times in the past where I worried a lot about what would happen, or success, failure. I've got a really good friend who worries a lot about what things look like on his CV. He can't really explain why. His resume. Entrepreneurship, I think, teaches you that none of that really matters. You just need to crack on with it and make the best choice you can, and whatever happens. Anytime what's been worried about disaster is a moment taken away from making sure that disaster doesn't happen. So get on with the second thing and ignore the pitfalls, because work on pitfall avoidance and management as opposed to pitfall concern.
I love that. I'm curious about, you're a very curious person in general, and wondering, is there anything you're learning more about, or trends or subcultures or things that you're following that you think other people should be taking notice of?
So one thing I follow very carefully is trends in venture investment. So big thing for people that run or invest in startups or early stage companies. But people often forget to think about the customers of these technology companies. And the trends happening right now in early and mid and late stage venture investment affect all technology companies, including all MarTech companies, including all everything to do with the broader advertising brand and marketing ecosystem. And I think it's quite important for marketers and brands to know what's happening to these emerging, exciting technologies, because the forces that influence them have fundamentally changed in the last 18 plus months. So So it used to be that money and capital was freely available. MarTech companies could build heavily loss-making businesses, and the number of customers you had in your rate of growth was all that was required to get you more money in the door. And how that came across to customers or clients of these businesses was these companies could spend a lot of money to build the product very quickly in a couple of years rather than a couple of decades. Often the product and the price was heavily subsidized. It's the venture capital funds paying for the product to be this good and subsidizing the price in order to trade off getting back speed and access and market share and unlocking in exchange. With the drying up of venture capital investment and the basis of how venture capital investment is made changing, these attacking and exciting new technology companies that marketers and brands and advertisers work with have to be more profitable, which means that they will grow more slowly. They have to focus on their unit economics, which means they can't offer these subsidies. They have to be more deliberate and slightly less risky, so they're a bit more resource constrained, which means that their product will be less fast to change, less responsive to feedback, but potentially much better in the long term. Many ideas and companies that used to be eligible for investment are now completely uninvestable because they don't fit these more modern criteria where things like profitability, some stability, payback, efficiency are rewarded by venture investors when in rewind 2-3 years, those things were basically completely irrelevant. So as customers of technology companies, particularly marketing technology companies, how those companies work and what they're focusing on and their basis of survival or extinction, that's really changed. So I think it's worth marketers in general being aware of how those companies are being affected and what your experience is going to be like. The good news is what you'll get back is much better products that are from companies that are more stable to the long term. There's likely to be slightly slower product development, but much less chaos. Their pricing is going to be a greater reflection of the value it costs to create the product, but also the value it creates for you. So I think this is a better version of the interaction between marketers and MarTech companies. But the root cause is the basis of how these companies evolve, are born, are funded, live and die has changed. And I think this is a trend or subculture that marketers should know about.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. It does seem that like the end result, to your point, is potentially better quality businesses and better quality products and services, even though it may take us a little longer to build them.
I hope so.
And longer term, I think you extrapolate that out. Hopefully that is a full benefit to society about more stability in our economic system as well.
I hope so.
Me too. Last question for you. What do you think is the largest opportunity or threat facing marketers today?
Let's talk about a threat, because it's more interesting and more evocative. So I think the biggest threat is that the pace at which marketers and brands can make mistakes and how those mistakes are amplified, and therefore the pace at which how fast a brand can be built or destroyed is faster today than ever before. If you took one of the most valuable brands in the world and asked Taylor Swift to actively defame it, would that brand lose 20, 30, 50% of its market cap in a day or two? Possibly. And we've seen many interesting cases of brands making terrible and highly avoidable mistakes, campaigns horribly misplaced, product launches that were massively wide of the mark, overt discrimination in some of their activities that now is coming to light. These mistakes not only happen at a faster pace, but the awareness of them spreads faster. They are amplified and built upon much faster. So the pace at which you can build or destroy a brand is faster than ever today. And being a big and global brand is actually quite risky. Being in the limelight as being a brand that is big and universal and that has deep pockets exposes you to a very wide and diverse range of interests, with the deep pockets that make it well worth attacking you, and the opportunity with this pace of change being so fast to vacate a whole bunch of market share and take it for yourself is far more available now than it was even a few years ago. So So I think the largest threat to marketers today is that these things can happen and become amplified so unbelievably quickly by social media, but also broader social trends and the pre-existing or resting interests that can activate very quickly amongst consumers, that you can get cancelled, you can get destroyed, you can lose large amounts of shareholder value and market share and long-term credibility and brand capital in minutes and hours rather than years and decades. And I think that is the biggest threat to facing marketers today. But if you are not one of those big companies that can accidentally form into the limelight for the wrong reasons or for the right reasons if you did do something wrong, it's a huge opportunity too. I'm not saying that brands should go out and create these massive changes, but they do create opportunities. I'll go back to a biology analogy. There are plants called pyrophytic plants where they live at the bottom of the forest. And in order for those seeds to germinate, they need the whole forest to be burnt to a crisp, to a series of little black matchsticks left behind. And then suddenly, within 3 days, the forest that used to be this tall climax forest full of trees is now ankle height, but completely green with a bunch of plants that you haven't seen since the last forest fire. And this is what causes the forest to rebuild so quickly. But these plants were sitting there waiting for this terrible climactic event, a fire to rage through the whole forest. And they were waiting. They need to be burnt, but they're ready for the opportunity. And when the treetop canopy is removed and suddenly you can grow at ground level, these plants are ready to grow there. So as marketers, there's opportunity in here too, where when something has happened, the key is to be ready. Be like one of those plants when a giant fire runs through. Be the one that survives. Get your leaves out, start to photosynthesize, and be ready to grow and reestablish the forest in a slightly different way that suits you. So big opportunities and threats out there, but there's forces for good as well as forces for evil.
Jeremy, it's always fascinating to have you on the show. Always welcome to come back. Thank you for spending so much time with us and sharing all the knowledge today.
A real pleasure. Yeah. Do come to our website, download the Zero Party Data Report. It's completely free and lots of interesting stats in there that we haven't spoken about today. Yeah. Always a pleasure and see you soon.
Hi, it's Alan again. Marketing Today was created and produced by me with post-production support from Sam Robertson. If you're new to Marketing Today, please feel free to write us a review on iTunes or your favorite listening platform. Don't forget to subscribe on marketingtodaypodcast.com. Tell your friends and colleagues about the show. I love hearing from listeners. You can contact me at marketingtodaypodcast.com. There you'll also find complete show notes and links to what was discussed in the episode today, and you can search our archives. I'm Alan Hart, and this is Marketing Today.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Hall, host of Sustainable Futures, Kantar's regular look at the intersection between brands, consumers, and sustainability. I want to help you to get your brand ready for the future, understand where you can make an impact, and make a smarter business case for products and services that are better for people, the planet, and for business. Sustainable Futures will showcase what great sustainable marketing looks like and the issues that matter to consumers across the globe. Subscribe to Sustainable Futures from Kantar, wherever you get your podcasts.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.